Hello, Melissa Doyle here, and welcome back to the Sunday Night Podcast. Since the 70s, Jimmy Barnes has been singing his heart out, hit after hit, that in some ways told the story of our lives. But only recently has he found the will and the courage to confront his own life, his own demons, all those drugs, all the booze. In this extended interview, Rani Sadler finds there's much more to the story behind the working class man.
Jimmy, you've been through a lot in your life, and we're going to go through a bit of that.
Drag me through it again.
Drag you through it again. But I want to ask you how you're doing now. It seems like you've never been so happy.
Well, you know, it's... You know, I'm a happy chap, essentially. Even when I was going through the thick of it, I tried to stay happy. But at the moment, you know, I'm healthy. I've got a lot of demons, off my back, you know, writing these two books. I'm making music. I'm playing with my own band and with my best mates in Cold Chisel. I've got my beautiful wife loves me. We've got a great house and 13 grandkids and a great grandchild. So, you know, what have I got not to be happy about, really? Yeah, I'm doing what I love.
13 grandkids and a great grandchild.
We started very young. We'd be too young, I think.
You mentioned the book, and you describe writing the two biographies as enlightening and disturbing. And you said in Working Class Boy, you learned to let go of what happened to you as a child. And in this book, you've had to learn to forgive yourself.
Yeah, well, you know, even letting go of the first thing, you know, the stuff in the first book was stuff that really poisoned me for most of my life. You know, there's things like shame and fear and you know, kids have a way of taking on guilt for stuff that they don't really, it's nothing to do with them really. You know, you feel guilty that your parents suffered or, you know, struggled or whatever. So, you know, there was all that stuff. And then there was violence and abuse and all those things that I went through as a child. Getting those off my shoulders when I wrote the book. I remember writing the book, and as I was writing it, there was a lot of stuff that I'd forgotten about, but it was all in there sort of festering, you know? And so I was writing away the book, and then I'd remember things that I hadn't thought about for, you know, 35 years, 40 years, and I'd go, oh, and I'd write about it. And I'd finish the day, and I'd feel like I'd something had been lifted off my shoulders. Other times I'd be writing, and then things would start to occur to me that are really dark, that I hadn't, you know, thought about at all since it happened. And then I'd go lie in bed and I'd be staring at the roof and, you know. So, but the process of, you know, it was really about letting go. So when I finished writing the book, I remember feeling that I could have, you know, just burnt it then, because getting it out already was enough. Then I took it on the road and did, you know, 50 shows where I spoke about it. And I was so surprised how many people, you know, related to it, you know, had been going through similar things. So many people had, you know, stuff in their lives they haven't spoken about, and this sort of opened the floodgate.
What do you think was your greatest mistake?
My greatest mistake was, you know, just, you know, thinking I could do this alone. I could get through life without help. You know, from the time of a young child, I found that I had to really just lock myself down and look after myself, and I wouldn't talk to anybody, and I wouldn't, you know, anybody asked me anything, I was always, yeah, I'm great, I'm really great, I'm all, you know, and that happened right through my formative years, and then in manhood, and when, you know, I became a rock singer, and then, you know, a father and a husband and all that sort of stuff, and I could feel myself imploding. But I would never ask for help because I thought it was, you know, I was either ashamed to talk about anything, or I thought it was not the blokey, the manly, the tough thing to do. You know, you have to, men handle this shit on their own, you know, which is, you know, that's absolutely my biggest mistake.
You talk about, obviously, a lot about your childhood. I remember one bit about, you talk about Glenelg Pier. You used to run away and sit on the edge of the pier and look out and dream of a better life.
Yeah. I used to do lots of things. I used to look out. I had to get away from Elizabeth because where we were living, it was very, very tough. And it was, you know, there was, you know, everything in the house, you know, the house was falling apart. My parents were falling apart. The furniture was falling apart. And there was no food. There was, you know, there was the violence and resentment from my parents for each other. You know, it was like, it was stifling. It was literally suffocate me. And I'd run away just to get away from it. And I'd get to the beach, not knowing, with the full intention of running away, but I'd get to the beach normally and I'd sit there and suddenly I could breathe and I could sit there and look out to the sea. And then I'd think about it for a while, and I can look back at it now and see that at that point, you know, I was thinking about jumping in, you know. I was thinking about, you know, maybe I should just swim off.
In 2012, things did catch up with you. You were always chased by voices and telling you weren't good enough.
Yeah, and it wasn't sort of like, you know, it wasn't sort of like The Exorcist hearing things in my head. I was just constantly, you know, I remember people, you know, my mum would say, this is where you belong, son. You belong here with us. You know, you don't want to be up there with those toffee people, you know. You know, you belong back here with us. These are your people. You know, rich, you know, like them, you know. Come and stay with us. And I'm looking at them thinking, you know, like, you've got nothing and you're you're unhappy. You know, you're really unhappy. But, you know, I don't belong here. I want to find something else. But I would sort of constantly, you know, no matter what, I grew up thinking, you know, all right, I don't belong in anything good. I don't deserve to have opportunities. I don't deserve to have, you know, and I'd cover that up by trying to be the best at whatever I was doing. At school, I'd be top of my class. I'd be a captain of the football team, you know. When I got a bit older, I joined gangs and I could fight better than most of them in the gang. You know, I was as tough as I had to be, you know. And then when I joined a band, it was like, you know, okay, we get people to like you, you know. So I needed other people to tell me how good I was because I was constantly dragging myself down. And these things that I heard myself were about that wasn't good enough could only be taken away by outside sort of, you know, reassurance of how good I was. It's a bit sad.
And that all stemmed from your childhood. I think you said, my house was not safe, it wasn't warm, there was no one there to look out for me. I was safer outside in the rain than I was in my own bed.
Yeah. I mean, there was, you know, people in our house that shouldn't have been around children, you know. We were, you know, being abused and, you know, all sorts of stuff in our house. And my parents, you know, I love my parents, you know. Talking about this stuff in the book has caused some issues between my, you know, members of the family, because we all have different sort of views of this. But I love my parents as much as anybody, but they had so many problems. They had so many problems. They couldn't deal with us. They couldn't cope with us. And we were, you know, as a, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 year old boy, you know, being left alone, you know, and being surrounded by violence, you know, people getting bottled and bloody stabbed and belted, and your mum flying across the room, and, you know, your bloody, you know, weird, you know, sexual promiscuity going on in the house all the time, and I, you know, didn't know who to trust ever. It was, for me, I would climb out the window, and I'd go, and I was, you know, I was afraid of Everett, and I was scared of the dark, but I would climb out the window and go and sleep in the paddock by myself, because it was safer than being in my own bed, you know, because you didn't know who was going to be in the house. So, and plus you didn't want to hear, you know, you can only hear your parents yelling and screaming abuse at each other or throwing punches at each other so many times before you have to get away, you know. And that was, you know, and that was what we were all like, all our kids, we were all afraid.
You say someone was messing with the kids and as a result of that, you've been subconsciously trying to kill yourself all your life.
Yeah.
And that period of your life seems to be the key to the whole mess.
Well, that's, you know, that's part of the shame and part of the, you know, the and the fear, you know. I mean, I didn't feel safe in my house. I felt so unsafe in my house. Like I said, I would escape at night. I'm talking at 5, 6 years old. I'd be outside, you know. Like, I think about my children now being out in the house on their own, and it would, you know, it terrifies me. But my siblings, and there was people in our house who were, you know, abusing us, you know, and that happened at different times in our lives, and it got to the point where I escaped. I used to stay out of the house as much as I could, and I remember I went and stayed with a family down the road with my mate, who was a friend from school, and he was one of, you know, a bunch of brothers, you know, and I used to go and stay there all the time to escape my house, and then his brother tried to, you know, abuse us, you know, tried to shag me, basically, and I was, you know, 7 years old, and he'd just got out of jail. And he came home, and the end. I remember fighting him off, and climbing out the window in the middle of the night. And as I look back, he was, you know, shagging his own brother. It was just, it was horrendous, horrendous sort of horrible place to be. And the thing was, I didn't sort of complain about this or think, you know, I thought this was normal behavior. This is what happened to everybody around us. You know, this is what happened in our streets. This is what happened. There was people in our streets who were much worse than we were. And so, you know, as I grew up, I just thought that was a normal childhood. You know, I didn't think that behavior was normal, but I just thought everybody suffered. Everybody went through. Everybody was afraid. Everybody was had something to hide. And so, you know, as I grew up, I wanted to run away as far away from that as I could possibly get. And I remember during cold chisel when I was, 16 and a half, 17, and that was it. I was gone and I was never coming back. You know, I didn't want to have to go back and see any of this stuff again. I didn't want, you know, and now I go back and I go back to Adelaide. Last time I was back there, I was doing the book tour. And I drove out to Elizabeth to drive past and have a look at where I lived and where I went to school and all that. And it looks worse now than it did even when I was there. And I feel sad for the people living there. And I'm not saying they're all going through the same sort of stuff as us, but really, you haven't got a chance if you're living in that sort of those sort of conditions. If you're, you know, your families are trying to get by and try to look after their kids. So there's just, they need help. You know, the government needs to help. We need better, you know. Need better school, just better, you know, kids, I think kids should be fed at school, you know. We used to go to school and we're hungry, you know. I was top of my class, but I'd be sitting there and my stomach would be rumbling and I couldn't focus on anything, and I was still top of my class, you know. I mean, if you have, you know, at least if you can get a meal and you feel safe at school, you know, you can do some work and you can better yourself. There's so many problems that we have, and I look at these poor kids that are out there still going through it, and it just breaks my heart.
Because your dad drank away all the money, didn't he?
Well, my dad drank it and gambled it. and you know, he used to say, like he drank the money, I gambled it and wasted the rest. my dad had his own set of problems. My dad, you know, was came from a violent, violent place. You know, my dad was a fighter. He was literally a boxer, and his dad was a bare knuckles boxer and a fighter, and I'm sure that he came from a very violent home. His mother, I don't remember his mum. She died quite young from liver disease from drinking. Came from a long line of alcoholics, and he was genetically an alcoholic before he started, you know. So my dad really, you know, without making excuses for my parents, they came from worse childhoods than I had, so they didn't have a chance. You know, they didn't know how to cope with raising kids or raising a family, and literally they had five kids in 5 years, and then another one a couple of years later. Then it was, you know, they didn't know how to look after one of us, never mind six of us. You know,
there was violence on both sides.
Yeah.
But you describe the menacing look in your dad's eyes.
Well, my dad was a real pacifist. My dad was really sweet. You know, he was really, but you know, he was one of those guys when he's backed in a corner, you know, he could, you know, that was it. You know, he had this thing where I remember him pushing his glasses used to slip down his face and he'd push them up. And when he was doing that, you know, it was like, clear the room. You know, he was like, you know, he was gonna belt somebody. But my dad, my mum would corner him too. My mum was as bad as him. You know, they'd bloody belt the shit out of each other. You know, she'd hitting him with stiletto heels. And you know, I remember one time she came up behind him with a stiletto heel, hit him about 8 times. There was blood squirting everywhere, and he just knocked her out. You know, but it was, who knows what got it to that point, how much violence or whatever it was. I don't know what was going on. They're both very promiscuous. They were both really pushing each other's buttons to the max and out of control. You know, when you're drunk, when you're ashamed, when you're scrambling, when you're, you know, it, you know, you make really bad decisions. Yeah.
Your sister would take you to hide in the cupboard.
Literally, like a big wardrobe. We'd go and sit in there because she tried to muffle the sounds of the violence, you know, because they'd have parties, they'd have friends over, and they'd always end up with fights at these parties because whether, you know, somebody touched up somebody else's wife, which, you know, they were all doing, it was very promiscuous, and there'd be somebody getting glassed or something, and so, or my mum and dad would end up, you know, their mates would go and they'd all be drunk and then they'd start fighting, and she'd take us into the wardrobe, the six kids, but the four smaller ones, she'd take it to the wardrobe and she'd cover us up with pillows and coats, you know, to muffle the noise so we couldn't hear the violence and what they were calling each other and stuff. And And eventually, you know, like that happened a lot. And we'd you know, eventually it'd go quiet, you know, and you know, it'd be screaming and yelling and shouting, and it'd go really quiet. And that would mean that would sort of normally meant something bad had happened, you know, and we'd wait for it to sort of see if it was going to erupt again, and then crawl out the cupboard and we'd find, you know, the furniture smashed and glass and blood on the floor, and Mum would be in a corner or Dad would be passed out somewhere. Just, and this was going on all the time. It was not healthy. It was not, you know, not a good place to grow up. You know, it wasn't safe.
You mentioned before you were talking about poverty, and you were saying it's impossible for those people to escape. Yeah. How did you get out?
You know, I'm one of these people. I'm sort of lucky, you know. I mean, it's hard to say when you're growing up like that that you're lucky. But you know, I was, you know, in the middle of all this violence and this horrendous behaviour in our house. Someone, like, whether it was, you know, there was an auntie, like, who was a friend of the family, who used to take me in and let me stay at her place, you know, for days. And she must have known that my parents were going through bad times or something. And she'd take me over there and feed me and all that. So I'd have these little windows of hope, you know, and I'd go there and I'd feel what it was like to be normal. But I'd always have to go back, unfortunately. So there was always people who popped up who looked after me. And, you know, eventually Reg Barnes came into the picture, my stepfather. And he was like a, you know, a shining light to me. You know, he came in and he was, he didn't drink. He was a, you know, really placid and pacifist sort of bloke. You know, I have theories about Rage as well. He was slightly effeminate, but he was a really, really, really sweet guy. And he sort of tried to teach you about morals and, you know, teach you, you know, you can't just be violent. You know, you can't. And why not? You know. but so, you know, and I've always found people like that. And eventually, I got away because I joined a band. You know, I met Don Walker and Ian Moss, you know, and then eventually Steve Presrich as well and Phil Small. And I left Adelaide with that band. And they were, and that was sort of my meal ticket, my ticket out of there. I wasn't, you know, I was going to run away if I had to jump on a train or climb onto the back of a truck to get out of Adelaide. I was going to get out of there because I was dying. And
you were just 16.
Yeah, 16. I just wanted to get out. I was, by that point, at 16 years old, I was, you know, taking LSD 5 times a week. I was, you know, drinking like a fish. I was in gangs. We were fighting most nights. You know, like fighting with other gangs and fight, you know, going to pubs and fighting and, you know, fighting bikie gangs. And it was just full on, you know, and really, I mean, really violent, really, really violent. And I just didn't want to be around it. I just thought, I've got to get, if I don't get out of here, I'm going to die. And then Cold Chisel came and that was it. I was gone. And I didn't want to go back.
You were asked to audition for them. Tell me about the audition.
Well, they actually wanted my brother John to join first, because John was quite successful as a senior drummer in Adelaide. But he was making money, and these guys were just like it was almost one step beyond a garage band. So they asked me to come out and try out. I remember I was in this Elizabeth Shopping Centre where we all used to go and hang out the gang and fight and stuff. And I was up there, and this hippie guy sort of said, "Hey man, want to come try it for our band?" And the first thing I thought was, "Don't call me man, you know, I didn't like hippies, I was going to punch holes in his aura, you know." but anyway, he said, "Oh, why don't you come try it for the band?" And he gave me an address. He said, "Saturday afternoon, come and try it for this band." And I went into town, caught the train into town, and the address was a Women's Liberation Hall in Adelaide. This is where the band was rehearsing, and I thought it was very funny. So I went up there and I'd been in a band for a while with my mates. These were just mates from the gang. I'd never actually auditioned for a band, and I wasn't very confident. You know, didn't. So I didn't take rejection well. I didn't want to say bad things about me, because then I'd get angry and I'd smash them. But I planned on the way up. I thought, well, if they don't like me, I'll just belt one of them. You know, that's, you know. So you know, I was quite prepared to do that.
Who do you reckon you would have belted first?
Oh, probably Mossy would have been closest. But he's such a nice fella. I couldn't have done it. Maybe Les, the bass player. Les would have swung back at me. But I didn't have to. I got there, and I was just my. This is what I'm going through in the train on the way up. Like, oh, if they say anything bad about me, you know, because I didn't like anybody to judge me, you know. And I can look back and see how anybody would have judged you badly for what you were. But I got there, and they were a good band. They even at that early stage, they had something that caught my ear. You know, Mossy was exceptional. Don played really nice piano. You know, Les, the bass player, had, you know, had the flashiest gear in the world. I didn't, you know, but I remember hearing this music, something in the music that made me feel good. And they liked the same music as me. I remember I did a song called Stealer by Free. And Free were my favorite band in the world. So when they asked me to do that, it was easy, you know? So I sang the song, and from the minute we played it, I knew that I could get away from here with this band. And I didn't care where they took me, as long as it was away. I just wanted out.
Your shows were legendarily wild.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's because the crowd was wild or because you were so energetic, so you wanted your music to be...
We were pretty wild. I mean, when I say we, I mean, I think more me. Because the band were really a bluesy sort of band. You know, they were pretty, you know, Don would write nice things, and Ian would want to play blues licks, and I just go, come on, you can't. If we do that, we're going to get killed. So I used to just really push the band to play harder and faster and louder every night of the week. So much so, I'd be jumping on Ian's back and I'd be turning his amps up when he wasn't looking, and I'd be threatening people, and, you know, the drummer, if he wouldn't play, I'd be pushing him and pushing, come on, play faster, you know. Steve would be swinging at me, you know. So it was, I think I was sort of responsible for a lot of it. But my job, I always see my job as a singer has always been the access point between the audience and the band. So these guys, they're really great. They can play great music. I'm supposed to be the one who judges what the audience want. And whether it was me, you know, projecting onto the audience, but they seemed to be pretty wild, so I wanted to make a wild show for them. They seemed to get wilder. I wanted to make it even wilder. And that just kept snowballing. And eventually, I've looked at sort of videos of old shows of Cold Chisel, and it's almost, you know, unbearable to listen to. It's so fast. It's so intense, it's so full on, and it just doesn't stop for a second. We do that, we go and play pubs all over Australia, and people would just be floored. You know, that was it. There was a period where for licensing in Australia, for pubs to stay open late, they used to have to serve meals. You know, that was how their loophole to get around the licensing laws. And, you know, at that point, I remember getting on when this happened and going on stage and people sitting there with their dinners, and I'm thinking, I don't want people eating while I'm singing. Fuck them, you know? So I'd jump off and jump on the stage and jump on the tables and kick their dinners over in the lap. While we were singing, I don't want you doing anything else but watching us. Look at me. You know, that was my job. And that's how we literally grab people by the throat to get their attention.
Literally.
So people would come and see us knowing that it was going to be wild, knowing it was going to be a good time, and knowing it could be close contact, you know, full contact.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I saw my first Cold Chisel show in 2011.
Yeah.
And I was just amazed the minute you walked out, the entire sea of people stood up and went wild.
Yeah, yeah, it's full on.
45-year-olds, you know, 55-year-olds.
Thinking they're 16.
Yeah, that's right. And dancing with their wife like they were 16.
Yeah,
what does that feel like when you walk
pretty,
on stage?
It's pretty amazing. I mean, and then when there was a series of shows, like we played the Entertainment Center here a lot of times. The first time we went back there, people from 35 years earlier when we did the last stand were buying the same seats and taking their kids to stand with them, like their sons and stuff, their dads with their, you know, so it's reliving their youths. So it's really great that people have not only stayed with us that long, but they brought their kids along or new kids have found us. I remember when Cold Chisel first reformed, I think it was 97 or something like that, 98. My son was at Cranbrook, a private school in Sydney. And I said, oh, you know, you want to come to the show? And he's going, yeah, you know, all my mates are big Cold Chisel fans. I said, what? Apparently Cold Chisel was a cool band with young high school kids, you know? So the songs stood the test of time, and it's really great that, you know, we 46 years ago we started or something, 45 years ago, and people are still finding us for the first time. People are still, you know, coming and seeing us for the first time, and people who've seen us 40 years ago are still coming to see the shows, and that says something about the songs and the honesty of the band.
When you first sang K-San, mm-hmm. Did you ever in a million years imagine it would become like an Australian anthem?
I didn't know. I thought it was a good song. I mean, Don, I'm sort of a huge fan of Don Walker's songs. I mean, I think it's something I've been really lucky to be the guy who gets to sing those songs, because I think they're the best songs, you know, the best songwriter in the country. K-San, when he brought it to us, we were at rehearsals, soundcheck at the Bondi Lifesaver, which is a very famous gig in Bondi Junction. really, it was a real famous rock and roll gig. And we were there and we were playing, you know, it was like midweek somewhere like that. I think we might even opening up for Skyhooks possibly, which we hated because we didn't want to open up for anybody. But nothing against Skyhooks. I remember we Don brought the song in and it was like a novel. You know, there were so many lyrics. And he said, here's the song. And we played it. And I remember he said, oh, we'll do it tonight. So he gave them the lyrics at 4 o'clock. And I had to sing it at 8. And so I was freaking out. So the first time we sang that song, I was just freaking out trying to remember the lyrics. I think I actually sort of mumbled quite a few of them through. But it must have been still impressive because Greg McCainch, who was the bass player from Skyhooks, who was the main songwriter, heard the song that night and seen it connect with people on the first night. And he left and he went back to Melbourne. He talked about this song that this band Cold Chisel, with this song about Vietnam that, you know, that somebody should sign this band. So, you know, Greg was one of the sort of champions of the band at the early on. So the song must have had an impact from the first night.
Something to really be proud of.
Yeah. I think, you know, I'm happy to be the guy who sang it, you know. Don should be really proud of writing it.
Yeah. Losing Steve, you've lost a lot of people, but losing Steve is one of the hardest.
Well, yeah, you know, it was always, you know, we always think we're here for the long haul. You know, we thought, you know, even when we broke up Cold Chisel, we thought, you know, we could always get back together and do if we really wanted to. And you sort of you do this with your family and your friends too. You take it for you know, take advantage of it. You think they're always going to be there. You know, like when Hutch died. You know, I remember I spoke to Hutch when he flew back in because he looked tired and worn out. And I spoke and said hello, and we're having a chat and a laugh. And I was living around the corner, like a couple, you know, half a mile from where he died. And I'll pop in. And he's going, yeah, we'll catch up, you know. And it's like, I should have gone around and seen him, you know. You always take your mates for advantage. And the same with Steve. I just thought Steve was always going to be there. And then when it happened so quick and he died, it was, you know, that was a big... You know, at that point, Cold Chisel, you know, we'd sort of reformed and we probably weren't going to really do any other shows. Steve was the guy who wanted the band to get back together. Steve was the guy who always said, we're mates, we've got to play music together. And we never did it. So when he died, we sort of didn't think we'd ever play music again. And then after a while, we thought, you know, that's not what Steve would have wanted. He wanted us to play. And I thought, you know, imagine if I lost, you know, Don or Phil, or, you know, or Ian, and never got to play with those guys again. These are the guys that bring me the most joy musically, you know, that I've ever had. They've been my best friends. They've been my family. So we thought, well, we should play. Yeah.
You talk about all the hard times. You talk about the drugs, and you talk about this extensively in your book. How old were you when you had your first drink?
I think it must have been 4 or 5. My dad used to wake us up on New Year's Eve and give us straight whiskey. Like a little shot each, because at midnight, because everybody had to have a whiskey, you know. So he'd be drunk and he'd sort of wake me up, you know. And then I remember they'd be having parties, like these wild parties that they'd have with all the, there wasn't any food, there was always lots of drink. But we'd wait till they passed out and we'd sneak out and we'd drink their drinks, you know, and or you know whatever they'd left around. The first time I got really, really drunk, so I was probably 8 or 9. And I mean, steaming drunk, falling over, vomiting and stuff. And then I started taking, you know, drugs when I was, you know, 12 or 13. You know, I mean hard drugs, you know, acid and, you know, speed and shit like that. I was never really, all my friends first sort of started taking, like, smoking pot and stuff. But, you know, it didn't do anything for me. It made me too soft. I didn't want to lose my guard. I wanted to be on edge so I could be, because I was defensive. So speed and anything that heightened my awareness was sort of what became my drug of choice. And that sort of went on for about, what time is it? Now for about 45 years or something.
Yeah. How bad did it get? I think you wrote you were drinking 3 or 4 bottles of vodka a day.
Yeah, that, depending on the day. You know, I'd drink from, I'd go to sleep with a full pint glass of straight vodka next to my bed. And I'd, you know, drink it in bed and I'd watch TV and I'd wake up and drink it in the morning. And, you know, I used to drink bottles and bottles and bottles and bottles of vodka a day. I would be snorting 10 grams of coke a day by myself. I'd take, you know, 8-10 ecstasy a day. I'd be snorting ketamine, which is an animal tranquilizer. And if you have too much ketamine, you fall over and spin out and end up, comatose. But that's what I wanted. People would take these little bits. I'd go, give me that shit, and just, because that's the only time I could keep still. So I was, I was a mess. And surprisingly, I wouldn't sleep for days. I remember I got to the point where I was awake for, eight days once, solid. And I was doing, I did 5 shows that week. And I was I'm so happy that might have been just before, mobile phones got really technical, and otherwise they'd be filming me everywhere. And I think there probably is anyway, but what can you do? You live with what you do. But I was just a mess, and and obviously that just led to all sorts of stuff. And, I was, any way to make me forget who I was, I wanted to do it. No matter what it was, anything that, anything that made me feel I wasn't me, anything that would take me away from my own, And I look back, I can look back and I go, oh, shit, what did I do that for? Why, why did I do this? And why have I, look at all the pain. But the thing is, I can't sort of regret all the things I've done and all the bad things I've done and the good things, because everything you do brings you to where you are, and where I am now is I'm really quite happy with it. I'm not perfect. I'm enjoying life. I like people. I like myself. And if it took all that to get to this, then thank God, I'm happy to be here.
You had to hit rock bottom.
Yeah, well, I bounced off rock bottom about 50 times. Really, I didn't. I was digging. There's a new definition for rock bottom since I tried. I tried to hit it.
In 2012, you hit it pretty hard.
Yeah.
And tell me about that night when you, I guess, nearly robbed your family of a.
Well, it wasn't like I was. Didn't think I was going to, try and kill myself or anything. I was just sort of. I didn't know what I was doing. I was just sort of on a bender that had gone for years. I was just at my wit's end. And I remember we were in New Zealand at a hotel, and we had a suite, which were literally, the suite was like, you could have fit the football field in it. It was that big, and it was that luxurious, and it was, and Jane and I, Jane was just sort of, she was rattled. She didn't know how much more she could take of me, And we were fighting all the time. I remember Jane passed out and went to sleep. And I couldn't sleep because of, the obvious reasons of taking so many drugs. So I gathered all the minibar, like everything, a couple of bottles of gin, a couple of bottles of bourbon, a couple of bottles of scotch, a couple of bottles of vodka, a couple of bottles of brandy. And I took them, I sat them next to the bed. By that time, I was taking sleeping tablets to sleep a lot, because it would take a lot to make me sleep. I didn't sleep well, and especially considering what I'd had. So I was just washing down sleeping tablets with these mini bottles, trying to knock myself down so I could get up and do something the next day, because I had another show to do. And I remember I just wasn't working, but I put a mask on, because even the red light on the TV, the off light on the TV was driving me crazy. I was like frayed nerves, My son David Campbell described me as having no skin. It was like just, I was a raw nerve. Everything, everywhere I looked, everything I felt just felt painful. And anyway, I finally passed out, and I woke up the next morning, and I could hear Jane in the lounge room, and she was cleaning up the mess I'd made, the bottles and all this sort of stuff, and putting things out. And I walked out, and she was trying to put on a brave face and trying to, Jane is always really positive. She's going, okay, let's start fresh, dear. Let's go for a walk, and can we forget all this stuff? And I'm saying, yeah, I'll try, And I thought, I'll get dressed. And I went in, there was a separate, like a cupboard where the dressing room is. And I went in there to get dressed, and I was putting my jeans on, and I seen this bloody thing, and suddenly I thought I'd passed out when I put the mask on and finished all these bottles off. But I must have got up again, and it started coming back to me. I started to remember, I got up and I just thought, this is just too hard. Life's too hard, and then I started thinking about friends who'd hung themselves and stuff like that, and I thought, well, how hard can that be? you know, it can't be that hard. So I tied the cord from a dressing gown around this rail, and then I remember I just dropped and put my full weight on it and lay there and to see. I wasn't thinking of killing myself. I was waiting. How hard is it to kill yourself in case I ever decide to do it? And up, you know, for all I know, that's how they did it as well. You know, it's an accident, but it's not that easy to die. It's not that easy to die. And I can remember vaguely going up, you know, trying for ages, and nothing happened. And so I just got up and passed out. And I didn't remember that until then. But I did. And when I seen this thing still tied around it all came back to me. So I quickly took it off and I put it back in the dressing gown. And I didn't tell anybody until much later. And then I told Jane about it, and it freaked her out. It's a happy story, isn't it?
It's terrifying. Yeah. I mean, when you think how close.
I know. And I just think about it. And I've listened, like I've said, I've got dear friends who've taken their lives that way. And when it makes me angry to think that they did that to their families. It makes me angry to think that they could be so selfish as to leave their children and their wives and their friends with that, you know. But then I didn't even think like that. That, and it could have been like that. It could have been gone, and I could have been the same, and I could have hurt my family even more than I had been already. So once again, whatever, something was looking out for me, and it's not easy to talk about that at all. But the reason I talk about it in this is because a lot of people get to that point, and a lot of people, you need to get help. That's what made me turn around and start looking for help. I got to the point I'm going, I can't do this, and I don't want to do this to my family, to my kids.
You think about your wife, you think about your kids, you think about your grandkids.
Yeah, I know. It's a horrific thing. And the thing was, and it wasn't like it was I was depressed. I was dark because I was just so out of it, and I couldn't see a way out. But I wasn't thinking of a way out. Death at all. This happened in a stupor and that's what happens. People make, like with Hutch or, you know, James Freud or whoever, people, friends of mine, good friends who've committed suicide, I know that it was just one bad decision, one minute, a moment in time that if you could take back, it would change everything. And they couldn't take it back. And for some reason, I'm here I am.
You so easily might not be sitting here.
Yeah, and you know, it's a just a slip of judgment, a slip of, you know, one drink too many, one thing, you know, and it's like, what can I tell you now?
You're making me cry. Anyway, you sought help.
I got help, and I see a therapist every week. You know, my therapist at first, you know, wanted me to see him 2-3 times. He would have wanted me to see him every day, I think. But, you know, I used to see him sometimes a couple of times a week, but mostly just once a week. But in the meantime, I'd been in and out of rehabs. I'd done a few rehabs. I remember I went to a rehab in America, and, you know, that got me straight and stopped the addiction. It cleared up the symptoms, and I didn't deal with any of the issues, you know, why I was trying to drink myself to death. And so I just went out, and very soon after that, I just kept it started again. I went to another one in Australia, which was a really good one, and I learned a lot from them. But at that point, I couldn't see a way back. I'd sort of painted myself into this corner where, you know, I was ashamed of everything I'd done. I was ashamed of my life. I was ashamed of, you know, even the good things. And so it didn't do any good. And it took to the point where I had to get to the point where I made that decision to help myself. I looked for help, which I, you know, I've always thought I was pretty brave, you know, even though I'm a fraidy cat, I've always thought I was pretty brave, but to look for help and ask somebody else for help, it took courage, and that for me was a big, big step, because I'd never really been courageous before. A lot of bravado, you know. And I was at the point where I was ready to sort of expel these demons, and literally between all the stuff that I'd done in the past that I'd learned from Deepak or from, you know, from monks or from, you know, rehab units or from, and even my therapist over the years, that when I started writing this book, all that stuff, because this stuff brought back a lot of pain, a lot of memories for me. And when I started writing this book, the help that I'd had in the past and the clarity I had at that point helped me get through it. And I think the writing process has been the biggest healing thing that I could have done. So it sounds painful to write, but I look at it now and I can look at all that and see, you know, I could write another book about the good things. You know, there's so much, I mean, my life has not been a drag. You know, there's been some very dark moments, but I've got so many moments to be, you know, just joyous about. You know, I look at how lucky I am and think, I didn't really have to get to the point where I lost everything like that to see how lucky I was. I knew that, you know, I've got a loving family, I have a beautiful, you know, wife who cares. I have the best kids in the world. I have friends who care, you know, and I get to do what I like. Every night I get to go on stage and share my emotions with people, you know, with strangers, and make strangers happy. It's pretty bloody good life, good job, you know?
You hid the robe cord from Jane. When did you tell her what you'd done?
It was a few days later, because she knew something, because I sort of was freaked out, and she knew something bad about it happened, so I told her about it. And she got angry, you know, but she was freaked out more than anything. And I didn't tell anybody else about it. And then I spoke to my therapist, you know, quite a few years ago now, 4 years ago, I spoke to him about it, and it was... And then he started, you know, and we started looking at serious work then, because I think he got worried about me. Writing the second book, you know, there's a lot of stuff in the book that's not pretty to look at from, you know, for me or for my family. But that was the one piece that I showed to my kids. That's the only piece they've read so far.
How did they?
You can ask Mahalia. I think you're going to talk to Mahalia, but. They were just all so happy I was still here. but I had to show them, not to freak them out, but because once it was out there, they had to know. But I didn't write this to be sensational or to sell books or whatever. I'm writing it to show where this can take you, where addiction can take you, where violence can take you, where poverty can take you, where fear can take you, where... trying to escape can take you, with where not dealing with your issues can take you. I wouldn't be this for good and for bad. I wouldn't be the person I am if I could have got help when I was a kid. You know, I just, you know, this book's about, you know, about basically it's really about poverty and ignorance and you know, as much money as I've made and as much help and love I've been shown, until I dealt with the shame of the poverty and the shame of that violence and ignorance, I couldn't take a step forward.
Not all the money or the adulation.
Nothing. Success. And I was getting primal therapy every night. I was getting out screaming at people every night of the week. It wasn't enough. you need to get help.
You left the band, or you didn't leave the band. The band broke up.
Yeah.
And then you started on your solo career.
Yeah.
You started recording pretty quickly, but you were really worried that you'd be terrible and everyone would laugh at you.
Well, I was, you know, like as I've said in the rest of this interview, I was, I, you know, I've inferiority complex. You know, I've always thought people looked down on me, and I thought, you know, I was waiting to fall apart, waiting to fail. So coming off the back of Cold Chisel, who. I left because, you know, it was for a bunch of things. I left the band. I decided to leave the band first. Then we decided to break up because things, you know, we really, for me, it was about, you know, I had to get out and do stuff on my own. I had to take some responsibility on my own. You know, with cultures, or you know, people think cultures are such a strong unit. We all had our jobs to do, but Don Walker was such a driving force in that band. He was such an amazing character in that band. You know, and we let Don do a lot of the work. You know, we were sort of a bit lazy. You know, I was happy to get up, drink, and sing, and fight, and be the party animal and all that sort of stuff. But it came down to hard work. Don was the guy putting the hard yards in. And I think we'd learned enough, as much as we could, from each other. So anyway, we broke up. I was terrified. Suddenly going out on my own, you know, I'd written maybe two songs per album at maximum, you know, and even, like I say in the book, most of those weren't that good either, you know, and it's hard to write songs that are good you know, that sound good compared to Don's songs, because every song he wrote sounded like, you know, that was the best song ever to me. So I was terrified of being compared to Cold Chisel. On a good night, Cold Chisel were as good as any band I've ever seen anywhere. You know, they were the best band in the world, and on the good night. So I thought, well, the longer I wait to go out and do something solo, the more I'll be compared. So literally, we finished in December 83 with The Last Stand, and early February, I was out and on tour with my own band. I put together a band. Ray Arnott had played drums on 20th Century for Cold Chisel. He'd filled in for Steve a few times. Ray was a drummer who played with the Dingoes, played with Stevie Wright. He played with lots of great things. I got Mal Eastick, who was a friend of mine from Adelaide, who played with Stars, who was a great guitar player. And it was a guy, Bruce Howe, who Bruce used to be in a band called Fraternity, which was the band that Bon Scott was in before he joined AC/DC. And when Bon left and joined AC/DC, I left Cold Chisel and joined Fraternity for a while. So Bruce was like a real mentor to me. He's a really incredible bass player.
And how many number one albums did you
have? Well, we went out, the album came in at number one, and then we had seven in a row. Seven number one albums that debuted at number one in a row, which was unheard of in this country, and sold a truckload of records. So, the first record was a bit scratchy, but I had good help. I had good band, and I had Mark Opitz, you know, guiding me. And from every record from there on, I found great people to work with, whether it was Jonathan Cain, you know, who wrote Working Class Man. Him and I wrote an album together, which became Freight Train Heart. I met Don Gaiman, who's an incredible record producer, who produced a whole bunch of things, including Soul Deep. When I finished my Chisel, that stint with Chisel, going out on my own, the first person I spoke to was Michael Gudinski.
Your voice, I think your neighbours in France, they said it sounded like you had an inbuilt speaker system.
Yeah.
You have a secret weapon, don't you?
Well, yeah, I don't know how I taught myself this, but there was many years ago, I lost my voice. I had laryngitis, and I couldn't sing, and I had to cancel a big show, so they had to get you have to get a doctor's note. That's what singers have to do that too, you know, for insurance and stuff. So anyway, this doctor came, and this doctor was a throat specialist who'd done operations on Elton John's throat, and he was like really world-renowned in Sydney. And he put a camera down the back of my throat, and he had me talking and singing. And he said to me that when I talk, I use my, you have two main vocal cords like this. When you talk, most people use them. When they sing, most people use those. And when you get really bad, you get nodules on those, right? And that's why people have surgery for the throat. Whenever I sang, he said I'd taught myself to use the surrounded by secondary chords. They're called false chords. And when I sing, apparently I use my false chords. And the false chords don't get nodules and don't wear out. So there's been times where I can't speak, but I can still sing. and it's so, you know, I remember at 17 years old, first thing I ever read, you know, a Cold Chisel review said that I would last 6 months and I would have no voice left. And it's 45 years later, and I'm singing better than I did then. So it's like I don't know how I taught myself to do it, but whatever it is, it's a real, you know, thank you.
Yeah, because I remember saying myself the night I saw you sing, how does he do this after night after night?
It's like a Mack truck. Literally, once it gets warmed up, it's just really hard to stop it. I can do it all night. It's good.
When you were little, when did people first notice you could sing?
I probably didn't really realize I could, you know, everybody sang in my house. You know, my mom and dad sang, you know, my brothers and sisters sang. You know, we sang stupid songs at, you know, parties. They'd make it like bring us out like Dancing Monkeys. Yeah, sing a song, you know, so we'd sing. When I went to school, the first couple of years of school, I remember I was being 6 years old, and I used to get sent, 5 or 6 years old, I used to get sent around all the classes to sing in the mornings, you know, because I think the teacher was trying to get rid of me. but no, they liked my voice, so you know, I sang then, and then I was in choirs at school. I was in anywhere I could sing, I would do it. I joined a church choir, just not because I was religious, but just because I was, you know, I wanted to sing. Eventually I got kicked out of the choir, must have been 12 or something like that, because I was singing too loud. and I didn't blend in, and I was shattered. I was mortified. But not long after that, that's when I decided I was going to get in a band.
Is it right that your first stage appearance, you had your back to the audience?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I was at this, it was a sort of community centre in Elizabeth, near the Elizabeth Centre. And we went there, and my mate at the time, he was sort of the showboat. He was, you know, the long hair, and all the girls liked him, and, you know, I was just the quiet, sort of snakier one. I was just like the fighter. And we always thought he'd be a singer because he knew all the songs and he'd sang all the time. And we went to this community centre, and this little band was playing. It was his idea, his mates were in it. And he went there, and they wanted him to sing, and he was too busy. He was chatting up some chick or something, and he left. It was a pretty flaky mate. He used to leave me all the time. He dumped me there and left. So I was left there, and this band's playing, and their singer was sick. They didn't have a singer. So they asked me, because they thought if I could sing a little bit, could you come and sing, you know? So I'd never sang in front of an audience, so I was terrified. So I'd literally sang with my back to the crowd. And I think I used to do that even quite a lot at the start of the early cultures or days. It was pretty, pretty shy, yeah.
Was that one of the most confronting things of your life when your children came to see you in rehab and told you about the pain you'd caused them?
That was one of many confronting things in my life. Yeah, you know, I mean, I knew that, you know, the kids would have been hurt and seeing the state I was in, and, you know, because I was really close to them, you know. I am really close to them. You know, my kids are, we did everything together. And when I started getting really bad, they could see it because I withdrew and I was, you know, I was ashamed. I didn't want them to see how I was, and I'd sort of hide in my room. And, you know, so when they came and they told me stuff in rehab, it just really, you know, and I had to face it, and I couldn't sort of lash out and get drunk to bury the shame. And I was had to sit and live with it. It was really tough, really tough. You know, Mahalia will tell you stuff. I mean, there was times where Mahalia used to sing in my band, and she used to ring me in the morning to wake me up, and I wouldn't answer the phone. And she said many times she came to the door and got the key to get in, expecting to find me dead, you know. And I didn't know that. So, you know, and I look back on that now, and it just, you know, that just really hurts, because, you know, how could I put somebody through that, you know?
Yeah. You say you have no regrets, but
yeah, no, but you know, but I can't take it back. It's made her strong. She's a tough, strong cookie. I'm sure I've damaged him as well, you know, but, you know, it wasn't out of not loving them. It was not loving myself.
Yeah, in your own childhood. Yeah. You say that you don't blame your parents for everything that they did to you.
Well, I go through times when I say that, you know, when I finished the first book, I sat there and I thought, I can sit and say I don't blame anybody for this, you know. But then I'm halfway through the tour talking about it all the time, and I realize that, you know, they really messed up, and they messed me up, and I blame them. and I think, you know, really, how could you let us be hungry? How could my father drink all the money when we're, you know, starving, and we're at home? How could those two be so caught up in their own bullshit that we're being abused at home? So I blame them a bit, but, you know, in the end, it's sort of, there's nothing, you know, they have their own shit to deal with. They have their own stuff to deal with. So I can't, you know, I can't blame them for why I'm like I am. You know, they had their own problems, and their problems bled into mine, as probably mine bleed into our kids, you know. And if I hate them for that, then I'm gonna start hating myself again. So, you know, you have to learn to sort of forgive. But there's serious mistakes. I mean, really, I look back now, and I don't know how they could have not known that we were being abused. I don't know how, you know. And if they didn't, it was stupid. And if they did, why didn't they stop it? Because it happened at different times and in our lives. And these same people were being brought back into our lives by them. So, you know, who knows?
And abusing your children in the home.
Yeah, who knows? But it makes me angry. It makes me angry, yeah.
I bet it makes you really angry.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the things that would have driven you to fight.
Yeah, well, you know, I became a good fighter. And, you know, the thing is, all the stuff, like I said, I've said in the book, all this stuff about, you know, needing to be liked, needing approval, needing, you know, other people to value me because I couldn't value myself, was the sort of the perfect breeding, training ground to become a rock and roll singer. You know, basically, as a kid, I used to jump around going, look at me, please like me, you know, because I want the teachers to like me, because then I'd get good marks, and then maybe my mum and dad would like me, you know, and I'd be jumping around, look at me, I joined a band and I'm jumping around going, look at me, look at me. I just did the same thing as I did as a kid, only I did it as an adult, yeah?
So your whole life kind of was trying to impress your parents?
Valuing my own self. This is not something the shrink told me, by the way. I've realized this myself. Valuing my own sense of worth was on what other people thought of me. If somebody, you know, if somebody liked me, if somebody slept with me, if somebody bought my record, if somebody, you know, gave me an A at school, then I was worth something. I didn't have any worth on my own, you know? It was always sort of coming from outside.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you've addressed that now.
What do you think of me? No, I'm all right. I'm much better. I'm still working on it, but I'm a lot better. You know,
yeah.
I mean, that, once I realised that, then I was going, oh, shit, that's a bit pathetic, isn't it?
No, I mean, it's actually very similar to Bruce Springsteen, who experienced similar issues throughout
his life.
I
think a lot of singers, a lot of performers, and a lot of, you know, people in the public eye tend to do that. That's why they're in the public eye. You know, people who are really calm and you know, happy and content in themselves don't go jumping around looking for you know, show-offs are generally people looking for somebody to approve of them, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, you see those people out there and they go, oh, I know what you're up to. I know what you've been. I can, you know, wink at them, you know? But, and then you get it wrong and they're just assholes. It's a really sad thing.
So if you want your kid to be a rock star, you should mess them up
a bit. No, don't do it. Don't do it. There must be an easier way. Well, look at Mahalia. Mahalia's had a pretty good life, you know, compared to mine, but she has been. But she's, I think you just, all you do is love them and play really great music to them. And the same thing will happen. It's a lot less painful, and you know, and just tell them they're good. And then if they don't succeed, it's not going to be the end of the world to them. If I hadn't succeeded, I didn't have another choice. I was either succeeding or dying, you know, and sometimes it was both.
You said money was good, but with it, it brought its own problems.
Yeah, well, you know, but listen, I never had a drug problem because I could always afford drugs. Yeah, and I could, when I needed more, I could buy more. The only time I ever had drug problems is if the drug dealer was out of town. So money allowed me to just sort of try to cover for my inadequacies. You know, like if people didn't like me, I'd shut the bar. Yeah, you know, I'd buy the biggest gear. I'd put on more lights than anybody else. I'd throw the biggest parties. I'd be the wildest guy in the world. I'd have more drugs than anybody else and share them with everybody, you know. I spent a lot of money on drugs, but I'll tell you what, my mates bloody snorted a lot of it with me, you know, and that was me. Like, I just wanted people to like me. I'd do anything. And, you know, it didn't make me any happier. It didn't make me any, you know. There were times when I was young and I used to take drugs and I think it was fun. But I look back at it now and I realize that when it was fun and then my mates would stop and then I'd just keep going. You know, even from earliest age, I just wasn't, you know, they'd take, you know, one tab of acid, I'd take four, you know. They'd take, you know, they'd drink, you know, three vodkas and cokes, I'd drink a bottle. You know, it was always much more than having a good time with me. It was about completely not thinking, not feeling. I didn't want to feel ever. And I did a really good job for a long time. Eventually, though, no matter what I took, no matter what I drank, I could still feel, and there was no escape. That's when it got really dark. You know, it's good Scottish genes. You know, those, you know, years of alcoholism and stuff that come through my genes have kept me alive. You know, and the thing to do now is make sure that, you know, I use it for good and not evil.
Are you going to?
Yeah, absolutely.
14 top 40 albums with Cold Chisel, is that right?
And 13 hit solo. Yeah.
Solo albums. Yeah. Hit number ones.
Yeah.
Solo albums.
I've got 16 number one albums with Cold Chisel, which is more than the Beatles.
Not bad for a bloke who was born on the kitchen floor in Glasgow.
Really? Yeah, no kidding. So, and, you know, considering all the things we're spoken about, you know, I mean, I can look back at it and regardless of myself, I did okay.
Despite yourself.
Despite
you
myself.
You did okay.
Yeah, I did all right.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you,
Jimmy. That was great.
Is that
You're
right?
Such a great storyteller.
Oh, good. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to our Sunday Night Podcast. Don't forget to hit the subscribe button. And remember, you can find more information about all of our stories on our website and Facebook page. Until next time.